In just a moment, the President's News Conference. But first, start your day well-informed every morning throughout the busy week as NBC brings you World News Roundup, a convenient, complete report of all the overnight's events, prepared and produced by the NBC News staff with correspondents on the scene wherever the news happens. World News Roundup covers the national and international scenes in a concise and penetrating style, tailored specifically for your mid-morning rush. Tomorrow morning, join the millions of well-informed listeners who start the day right on top of the latest news with World News Roundup. It's part of NBC's continuing news coverage for you. Now stay tuned for the President's News Conference on NBC. The National Broadcasting Company again takes you to President Eisenhower's news conference, just as he spoke to Washington reporters today. By radio tape recording, we bring you the President's 62nd news conference, held in the Treaty Room of the old State Department building across the street from the White House. There were 188 reporters on hand today as the President crossed the street, rode up four flights on the elevator, and walked to the desk in room 474. Newsmen rose in salute to the President. He waved a hand and said, "Please sit down." And then the news conference began like this.
Good morning. Two individuals I'd like to mention this morning. As to His Holiness the Pope, his 79th birthday, a man that I've had the honor of visiting personally, admiring him greatly, and particularly because of his unbroken record of opposition to all forms of fascism and communism. I'm quite certain that America, all America, would wish this great spiritual leader a very happy day today and many more of them. The other man is Ambassador Caffrey, just now retiring from the diplomatic service, and who holds the American record for a length of time as head of a mission. For 29 years, he's been head of an American mission in some foreign country, has been responsible for for solutions to many serious problems, or at least helpful, and leaves with a brilliant record and the best wishes of the entire department. The interesting life he's led, as described by him to me this morning in a short interview, was seen to me to provide some inspiration for able young Americans to go into that same service. A service that is constantly devoting itself, dedicating itself to the welfare of the United States all over the world. That's the only announcements I had. We'll go to questions.
Mr. President, Smith of the United Press. Mr. Churchill said yesterday that Western superiority in the hydrogen bomb will prevent Russia from starting a big war within the next 3 or 4 years. Now, from this, or from your own sources of information, do you get the idea that Russia will pull even with the West in 3 or 4 years?
Anything dealing with such a subject, any conclusion, is really nothing more than a speculative estimate. However, we do know that the Western world has had and enjoyed a great lead in this whole field, both in the atomic fission and the atomic fusion. Now, exactly how long that lead can be sustained is problematical, and again, another factor enters this question. There comes a time, possibly, when a lead is not significant in the defensive arrangements of a country. If you get enough of a particular type of weapon, I doubt that it is particularly important to have a lot more of it. So I think that it would be unwise to attempt any fixed conclusions based on the information available to any of us in the world.
Reston of the Times. Sir, I wonder if you could straighten us out on your economic foreign policy for Asia. About 3 months ago, Mr. Stassen and Mr. Dulles sought out the press to develop the thesis that our policy was out of balance, that we had to have a large new economic policy for Asia. Then Mr. Humphrey seemed to knock that down. And now, yesterday, Mr. assassin seems to have announced in New Delhi that you are sending a new program to the Hill next month.
Well, Mr. Reston, I think the things that you talk about as being indicative of a struggle within the administration are merely evidences of the long-term and intensive study that's been taking place here. This is not an easy subject. We had a tremendous change in the Far Eastern situation over the past year, the ceasefire in Indochina, where we had been devoting a very great deal of money, as you know. Now, to take a new look at the situation and what is needed has involved a very long and earnest study. And in the meantime, CETO has come into existence so that, as far as I know, there has been no great differences in final conclusions. There have been different viewpoints presented, and eventually, and there is evolving a plan soon to be crystallized, that will be brought out to the Congress for its approval and for implementation. But that's as far as you can say anything definitely on the thing at this time. It will be one we will hope will be helpful to all our friends in that area. This gentleman here.
Scripps Howard newspapers. During the last week, there's been published a suggestion, now supported by a resolution in the Senate, that the United States try to get all nations, including Russia, to agree to devote more of their resources to raising living standards, more butter rather than fewer guns. Could you give us your thoughts on the general idea that by giving higher priorities to living standards, have a form of economic disarmament?
I find here recently more and more occasions to referring to my favorite author. I think you might find this same idea in a speech I delivered, I believe, on April 16th, 1953. The United States could not be more devoted to the idea of the products of humans being devoted to human welfare and less to human destruction than we now are. We believe in it thoroughly. Now, every one of these plans that's brought forward always has to make this one assumption that there are ways and means available to us for making certain that everybody's acting in good faith. Good faith is the ingredient that must be implicit in any plan that is finally adopted and which can gain the confidence of people who don't want to fight. And we know we'll never start an aggressive war. We just want to devote ourselves to the prosperity and security, happiness and safety, greater liberty and development of our own people and of our friends in the world. So any plan, I believe there can be a dozen different variations of a plan for disarmament if it is approached in good faith. And now that is the thing that we must seek, we must try to build, and when you come down to it, possibly. Possibly the best way to define American policy abroad in this whole field is how do we develop good faith among the nations so that all peoples can be confident in the words of others.
Joseph Harsh, the Christian Science Monitor. 2 weeks ago, you discussed your early post-war invitation to Marshal Zhukov to visit you. And you said at that time that you would be willing to consider renewing the invitation. Has there been any consideration of that, and if so, any result?
Well, I thought it over personally. And as of this moment, I am not going to issue one. I think there's a lot of things going on in the world. I am going to certainly wait till I discuss again with the Secretary of State the conditions that have been developing over the past couple of weeks. But I repeat that in those days, I liked him. I thought he was a very able man. And from the personal standpoint, of course, it would be very interesting to see him again. But it's something I haven't forgotten, Mr. Harsh. I'm just not ready to give a final answer on it.
Fletcher Knebel, the Coles publication. What do you think of the suggestion advanced out in Iowa and now seconded very heartily by a an official Soviet publication called Soviet Agriculture, that a group of Russians come out to Iowa and see how we grow the tall corn and the hog.
I think, and I believe I've told this before in front of this body, I think the Russian people as such don't want war any more than we do. They want opportunities to advance themselves economically, culturally, and of course, traditionally, Russians are very devoted to all the artistic. Their aesthetic sense seems to be highly developed. Now, I couldn't imagine if we could relieve this question of all of the inhibitions and the limitations that occur to you because of the situation today in the world, I couldn't imagine anything better than to have some of their agricultural people visit our agricultural people. I visited once both state farms and collective farms in Russia, and there was no place where I was queried so insistently and in such detail as I was on those farms. People with their faces shining, you know, they have a technical expert they call an agronomist for each one of these installations. The agronomist, in one case was a woman, came up to me with a shining face and just as eager to take the opportunity to ask questions. How did you raise this? Fortunately for me, I was raised in a farming area, so I could answer some of the questions. But how much does a person get in the United States for doing this kind of work? How do you do these things? I'm so anxious to go see. I really believe this would be an area in which some good could come if we didn't have a dozen different difficulties of which we all know, one of which I believe is legal. We would have some difficulty in clearing things legally as under our present laws. There are a number of things to be studied and looked at, but just as a personal opinion as to what good might come out of it, these two peoples, these two representatives of agriculture getting together, I would say it would be good and good only.
Robert, the Washington Post. I'd like to ask a question about Formosa, since it's been about a month since the resolution was passed by Congress. Since that time, the Chinese nationalists have evacuated some islands. Diplomatic negotiations appear, publicly at least, not to have brought any ceasefire. I wonder if it's a fair conclusion to draw from that, as the situation now is, the question of peace or war in Asia lies entirely with the Chinese communists, or is anything or can anything more be done from our side?
Well, I think the first answer to that is you never give up in the pursuit of a legitimate and desirable objective. Merely because you're defeated the first time and discouraged and the conditions don't look particularly bright, you don't give up. Now, as Formosa and the immediate estimate of the situation there, our Secretary of State is there today. He is visiting with the Generalissimo, and by the time he comes back, certainly we'll have at least some new ideas or variations of ideas to put into our calculations. I should say, though, in general, that at least the Western world wants peace in that area. Therefore, the only way that we can be embroiled is through some action on the part of the opposing side.
Reports, Lawrence of the New York Times. There have been reports, especially in South American countries, sir, that the real mission of the ATCA in the Antarctic is to seek out some new proving grounds for either atomic or hydrogen weapons. Can you comment on whether the truth in that?
Well, Mr. Lawrence, the report is absolutely without foundation. There's absolutely no intent on the part of the United States to go down into that area explore for any such reason. The ship that went down there, this icebreaker, went down to do the preliminary logistic work for an expedition, scientific expedition, which will go down to do our part of what is called the world commitment in the developing the geophysical year of 1957-58. They're going down in merely a preparatory logistic exploration of how we will do our work, and it'll be done under scientists and for the development and benefit of the world, nothing else.
Clark Lyons, the head of the Senate GOP campaign committee, said the other day he doesn't think the Republican Party can win in 1956 without you as their candidate. I wonder how you feel about this view that you're indispensable to party victory and how it may affect your own plans in 1956.
Did you ever think what a fate civilization would suffer if there were such a thing as an indispensable man? When he went the way of all flesh, what would happen? It would be a calamity, wouldn't it? I don't think we need to fear that.
Mr. President.
Well, I guess.
Will you comment on the action of the Senate committee yesterday in voting down the $20 tax reduction?
Well, I was highly gratified. I explained my position on this whole tax proposition last week. I explained that I thought emphatically, even if rather sketchily, and I haven't changed my mind, and naturally I am delighted that the Senate has brought out on the floor a bill that does keep on the books the excise and the extra 5% corporation taxes, and at the same time doesn't go in for this.
Did you
other
read
country.
Mr. President? I understood, Garney Horner, the Washington Star, I understood you to say in discussing the question about Sir Winston Churchill's speech yesterday and the hydrogen bomb, that the Western world has had the lead in this whole field. Did you mean to put that in the past tense?
Well, I meant, I didn't mean that it doesn't have it now. I mean it has had all this time the lead. I did merely intimate that in such a thing as this, you couldn't say, looking on into the decades of the future, that this is to always to prevail. That's all I meant.
Mr. President, Abel, New York Times. In an interview with Senator Margaret Chase Smith, Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek has said rather recently that he expects United States moral and logistical support for a reinvasion of the Chinese mainland. Can you tell us, sir, whether this government has given the nationalists any reason to expect such support?
Well, I thought that this whole thing had been discussed so thoroughly there could be no question of America's attitude in this matter. The United States is not going to be a party to an aggressive war, and that's the best answer I can make to that.
Living after the star. The information has come from the commission. I'm Cole of the Indianapolis Star. The information has come from the Commission on Intergovernmental Relations that the states are all able to finance their own educational needs. And I was wondering, sir, if that had been brought to your attention and if it's true, if it would change your views on the needs of the requirements of the state for federal aid.
Well, I doubt that that's true in detail. I hadn't heard that before, but I doubt that it's true in detail, at least in view of information that comes to me from so many different sources. And in any event, I believe the problem to be so serious that the United States government must take a very positive and definite leadership in this direction. As you know, I am trying to make that leadership effective in a way that retains to the states and to the localities their traditional responsibilities. But I do want to get going.
Follier, Washington Post. This is another political question, Mr. President. We have some information on this, but it came to us secondhand from Chairman Leonard Hall. Would you, sir, as leader of the Republican Party, tell us how you feel about San Francisco as a convention city, about a late convention, and about a short and merry presidential campaign?
Well, when they asked me about this selection of cities, I didn't know all of the technical details of television and switching it from one convention to another, or all of the other things that so engaged the attention of the committees. I said I knew the climate of the areas, and I liked that of San Francisco better than I did of Chicago. That was my remark. Now, I don't know that the timing and the place has any a great effect on the succeeding campaign. I doubt that it has. I'd rather think it's a good thing to shift around from one city to another. Really, that was what I thought. Instead of always going back to the same place, switch around in this country. It's a big country, and if the place can accommodate the members of the convention, why, let's go there once in a while.
Marvin Aerosmith of the AP. Would you like to send any message to Vice President Nixon regarding his statement yesterday that he hopes you will seek re-election?
Did he say? Well, I tell you, as you people know, I've always expressed great admiration for Mr. Nixon. I think he is a splendid type of the younger men we want in government. On the comment he made, I will send him no special message. I probably will have something to say to him when I see him again.
Carol Inge, the editor syndicate. As you know, sir, the AFL and the CIO have signed an agreement to merge their organizations into one of 15 million members. Would you care, sir, to comment on its possible significance to the country and its various ramifications? And two, do you see in such a merger the danger of a labor monopoly?
Well, quite naturally, I have done a little speculating and thinking of my own on such an important question. I've asked people in the government who are and who can devote their whole time to this problem to give me their conclusions, and they will do so. My own mind will stay open on a lot of the facets of this particular movement and development, but by and large, I think this. I think the American people in their individualistic selves are very independent, and I would doubt that any organization can just set itself up and be in all phases of their political and economic and cultural life the bosses of any great number of Americans. I believe that there will be many counterbalancing factors in any attempt to make this just one great, say, a political organism or something of that kind, and be and these people be the bosses of that many Americans.
Mr. President, do you feel that there's such a tendency for there to be bosses over American workers who are members of unions?
Oh, did you? What's your?
If there's any tendency in that direction.
I didn't comment on that. I merely said that you were proposing the question in terms of politics. Well, I believe these people are going to be fairly independent politically, as always.
Mr. President, Shore, CBS News. Referring to your preference for the climate of San Francisco, can it be taken for granted that you will attend the convention?
No.
Zilke of the Toledo Blade, are you happy that Congress has decided to raise its pay and that of the judges?
Yes, I am. In the past, ladies and gentlemen, I have talked to a number of what I thought promising young people, people who are establishing themselves, about the possibility of them getting into government. And I find that particularly with respect to jobs that bring them to Washington, the economic factor has a very important bearing on their decisions. And frequently they must simply decline because they said, I'm a young fellow starting out and I can't do it. They must keep a home in their own places, in their own districts. They must go back off into those districts if they hope to be re-elected, and they have to be re-elected each 2 years, incidentally, which I think is a mistake. I'd like to see a 4-year term for them. And then they have to set up a new home here. And as you know, they do have unusual expenses. Now, they voted themselves this raise, but they also included judges and other parts of the judiciary who've been badly underpaid. And this administration has required, for example, that United States attorneys give up their private practices. They were allowed to do that in the past. We required to give them up. They should be paid well. And of course, finally, you say they've given themselves a $7,500 raise. We'll get half of it back. Don't forget that.
Mr. President, Shyamal of the Gannett newspaper, getting back to the Russian food situation, has there been any final decision on the proposal that we give them some of our wheat?
I keep hearing about this proposal that we give them some of our wheat, although I don't know where it came from. I believe there's an attorney general opinion. We may not barter. We may not sell. But we could give. Now, I want to point out that there's been no report made to us that Russia is really short of grain. On the contrary, within the last, I think, month or very recently, they shipped 300 and some thousand tons of grain out of the country. Now, the United States is never indifferent to human suffering. And in certain areas, as in the Danube area, just recently, we put in $10 million worth of wheat, flour, and agricultural products. There is no purpose and no plan being studied at this time for sending any grain of any kind to Russia.
Mr. President, in this connection with this Hayden of the Detroit News, sir, in connection with this question of will you or won't you run again, at a press conference some weeks ago, you commented that it was a rather large question and that sometime when you had plenty of time at a press conference, you would discuss, I believe you said, the pros and cons. Could we make a date with you, sir, to start at the next press conference?
I would doubt it, the next press conference. But I'll tell you, if we can have a complete moratorium on it, I might make a date, let's say, a year from today.
And so, President Eisenhower's 60-second meeting with the press, radio, and television ended 30 minutes and 50 seconds after it began. The version we have just brought you ran exactly 26 minutes. The White House had edited out some 5 minutes, material not considered of general interest and questions which produced largely negative answers. For instance, there was a question about attending groundbreaking for the St. Lawrence Waterway. The president said he had been invited, would try to go. There was a question about a judgeship in Texas. The president said he was sure the attorney general would recommend the man best qualified. There was a question about abolishing the Electoral College. The president said you could argue both sides. Our electoral system is awkward, but on the whole, it has operated well. Another question, which has been edited out by the president's new secretary, had to do with economist Leon Kaiserling's comments on the tax bill. The president doubted Kaiserling had a good plan. Finally, there was a long question whether the president thought the federal government should underwrite congressional campaign expenses. The president said he didn't think he could comment on it usefully, but he applauded the motive, trying to bring good men to Washington. Other than these few questions X'd out by the White House, you have heard the entire news conference. The president seemed to enjoy himself more than usual at today's session with reporters. There were no needling questions, and the queries that were put covered many issues, covered the waterfront, as one reporter put it. Mr. Eisenhower always seems to be his most effective, his most eloquent, when, like today, he is thinking out loud about the broad issues of war and peace. One other comment. Up until recently, sharp political questions seemed to bother the president, to make him ill at ease. Not so today. The answers which brought laughter all had to do with his running again, reporters trying in various ways to smoke out the president on the question. The president seemed to enjoy this particularly, but this reporter, for one, doubts whether there will be any moratorium on that recurring question about re-election. This is Ray Scherer, NBC White House correspondent.
This is the NBC Radio Network.